basal metabolic rate, we can measure in the lab as resting metabolic rate. It's a resting expenditure, and it very quickly can up and down regulate to try to compensate for caloric mismatches. It's a great evolutionary adaptation.
I think that's a really important point that a lot of people don't recognize. They go have their resting metabolic rate measured and they kind of think, that's my rate. That's who I am. Like, it's genetic. It's really so much more variable than that, and can be widely variable depending on activity rate, your dietary, nutritional status at the time, all kinds of things. Hi, everyone. This is The Podium, and I'm Dr. Kevin Sprouse. Our podcast originated as a resource for my practice, where I work with professional athletes and high-performing individuals from around the world. Today, it has become a forum for an even greater audience, and we welcome everyone as we discuss the principles of performance and then disseminate pertinent, actionable information with our patients in mind. One thing to note before we begin, the content of this podcast is not meant as medical advice. This is for general informational purposes only. Welcome to The Podium.
On today's episode, I had the great pleasure of getting to talk about nutritional physiology with Dr. Trent Stellingworth. I've really enjoyed Trent's work through the years and have kind of admired this from a distance. And it was a blast to get to sit down and have this conversation with him. As a way of a bit of introduction to Trent, Dr. Trent Stellingworth, he serves as a senior advisor in research and development at the Canadian Sport Institute of the Pacific in Victoria, Canada. His primary sport and research focuses are in the field of physiology and nutrition interactions, which is much of what we talk about today. He's also studied environmental stressors, altitude, heat, and more recently has done research into female health and performance, as well as something called RED S, which is relative energy deficiency syndrome, or kind of a lack of fueling appropriately for one's training load. He and I met, I guess, most recently when the International Olympic Committee was putting together a revised set of guidelines around this condition. And Trent was kind enough to reach out prior to that and ask if I would help kind of validate that process. Previously, Trent was a senior scientist in performance nutrition for PowerBar in Lausanne, Switzerland. He's also had more than 140 peer-reviewed scientific publications, authored 10 book chapters. These have been in areas of exercise physiology, skeletal muscle metabolism, sports nutrition, performance. So you can see we've got a real expert here today. And it was my pleasure to sit down and get to pick his brain a little bit. And selfishly, I hope that we can get him to come back on again and maybe go deep on some of these topics that some of the ones that we skimmed and could use a second go round. But I hope you enjoy the conversation with Trent as much as I did.
Well, Trent, thank you for taking the time to come on the show. I'm really excited to talk through a number of nutrition and physiology topics with you. Our paths have crossed multiple times through the years, but this is the first time we've actually sat and talked and met kind of pseudo face-to-face. So yeah,
thank you. It's great that our schedules finally allowed to connect here. And it took a little while. And yeah, I've kind of followed your work in pro cycling. And I have a few touch points into pro cycling, more into track and field and athletics. But it is great to meet you, Kevin.
Yeah, likewise. And I mean, I've followed your work. You're published at length on numerous topics. And we've kind of worked with or around athletes like Mike Woods and, you know, some of the folks in cycling that have gone between teams and may have Canadian background. So it's a lot of fun to sit down and finally meet virtually face to face.
No, that's great. Yeah. Mikey's a real proud point for Canada and is actually showing, more runners. There might be life after glass shins, because his lower body didn't hold up to running very well. But he's really had a heck of a, and continues to have a heck of a cycling career.
Well, running's loss was cycling's win. Yeah, so we were glad to get him, for sure.
There you go. Yeah.
Tell me a little bit about you from a historical background, biographical background.
both academically, I guess, but also athletically. I find most of us who end up in these positions have academic and athletic backgrounds.
Yeah, like I come from a tiny little town in Ontario in Canada, and was the first person in my extended family actually just to go to university. My dad's a mechanic, and he's quite cerebral and does theater and reads a lot. And I think I got a lot of my, you know, a pursuit of knowledge and questioning from him. But I ran track in high school, and I was a decent runner, miler, 800 runner, and so got a scholarship to go to the U.S. to Cornell University, and majored in nutrition there with a minor in exercise physiology while running Division I NCAA track. Was the captain my senior year there, and then got into research while at Cornell and got really interested in that pursuit. I was thinking medical school or chiropractic college, and then kind of fell in love with the idea of generating your own data and discovering new things through research. And so came back to Canada to the University of Guelph and did a master's and PhD. And that was 2000 to 2005. Helped coach the track team then. Still ran a fair amount at that point. Got married to my wife, Hillary, who's a two-time Olympian in the 1500.
Yeah.
And then we moved to Europe, and we lived in Maastricht, Netherlands for just over a year, year and a half while I did a postdoc. Maastricht is the site of the Amstel Gold Race, and our apartment was right across the street from the market where it departs.
Oh, nice.
And that's where I really started to fall in love with pro cycling. And I know all the little roads around there. Liège Bastogne-Liège is just down the road, and all the spring classics and cyclocross and cross country running. And we still have, my last name is Dutch. I have a Dutch passport. So we still have lots of family and friends there, and we try to get back when we can. And from there, I then got into industry. I was the R&D lead for PowerBar. At the time, PowerBar Sport Nutrition was owned by Nestle. And so we moved down to Lausanne, Switzerland for 5.5 years. And it was great for my wife's running career being based in Europe. Lausanne's a beautiful place to train.
Yeah.
We got into altitude training then, kind of like less from a research, more from just application, being in Switzerland and St. Moritz. And then from there, I got recruited back here to Canada. And I'm currently at the Canadian Sport Institute Pacific, which is one of our Olympic and Paralympic training centers here in Canada. And I'm the senior advisor director for research and development for the Institute. So I have various grad students and adjunct at a few universities, and still embedded in sport. I coach. My wife is the head coach at the local university for track and field, but I also coach several elite runners and Olympians and Canadian record holders across a few events. So try to keep half of my pursuits in kind of like research and academia, but then half of my pursuits in the reality of coaching and having to make decisions every Sunday, whether you have the information or not around, you know, what your athletes are going to do this week for training. So that was a long answer. Sorry.
No, it was great. It was great. I loved hearing it. My father-in-law ran track at Cornell, so I'm you know, very familiar with the program. And Cornell has one of the top nutrition programs in the States for sure. I mean, it's you've hit a lot of places that are really at kind of pinnacles in academia. Maastricht is an amazing place. Lausanne, I mean, the IOC is there. Amazing research that comes out of there. So you had a really fascinating path, as I hear you lay it out there. And I love the fact that you have kept one foot in the practical and one foot in the academic world. So often we tend to pigeonhole ourselves one way or the other, in whether it's performance or medicine or whatever else. And having that viewpoint where you can see each and work in each, I think is really, I would say it's very important. I would suspect that the practical really influences your coaching time really influences your academic questions that you answer and the research that you do, because it's answering something that you need to know the answer to coach appropriately.
Yeah, you really nailed it. And I think, recently, over the last 5 or 10 years, I've done a lot more research in female health and performance. And it started somewhat self-serving or selfish. My wife, we had questions we wanted to ask. She got anemic in her career. And I'm like, oh, there's just not a lot of stuff in elite runners. So we did a bunch of projects. Or she got pregnant. And I'm like, oh, man, there's nothing in the literature on female pregnancy. So we've published a paper on that now. And but very quickly, you realize that it's just such an unmet need there. And so it is now a real passion project and a real piece to expand on. And I also like think of the dichotomy this way is as a physiologist and sports scientist, you're really cautious to try to gather as much information as possible. And we're always, future research. We need more research. I'm not quite sure. We're always hedging our bets and not always being as definitive because we respect the chaos of the literature too much.
Yeah.
And we want everything wrapped up, you know, a consensus statement in a perfect little bowl with correlations of one. But as a physician or as a coach, we're rarely in those positions. So you have to make a diagnosis, whether or not you have all the information or not. I have to write a training program, whether I have all the information or not. Because if you don't make a diagnosis, your patient might get more ill, or if they're in the emergency, they might die. You know, you have to take action. You have to kind of put your neck out there and take the information. It's not perfect, and make a decision. And that's the dichotomy that I wrestle with sometimes as a researcher who appreciates the holes and the challenges and the lack of information, the lack of validation. But then as a coach or you as a clinician, you know, we still got to make decisions to the best ability that we have with the information that presents. And we never get our R squareds of ones and our perfect validation and correlations. Yeah.
No, it's true. And I came up through emergency medicine before doing sports. And there was always talk of being comfortable with diagnostic uncertainty. That
yes,
you just, as you laid out, you have to gather all the facts you can and then do something, right? Yeah. And I think the part about that that is even more difficult is to go to the patient or the athlete, the consumer, and be open that we don't know the full answer, but I'm very confident that this is the right path with what we know. And that could change in a while. Right.
Yes.
The next test could change it. The next year's literature could change it. And being humble enough to say, I don't know for sure, but I know that this is where we need to go right now. And that's tough.
Yes, it is. And, we may get on this a little bit later, helping lead write the new REDS clinical assessment diagnostic tool was challenging for me as a researcher and a scientist because it's not perfect. It's not all perfectly validated. It's multifactorial. It's complex. It's like other diagnoses that are a multifactorial approach with differentials that you need to exclude. And, as some sports scientists, it's a challenge to wrap your head around that initially because, it's mainly correlative data and associative data, and there's not a lot of interventions here. And that, you know, is this a real thing? Are we overdiagnosing? Are we underdiagnosing? And, the way I've separated that is that our training as sports scientists and physiologists is always about seeking the truth, but your training as a physician, especially in medicine or a coach, is we seek the truth, but we also have to make decisions and crack on. So,
yeah, we need to reach an outcome.
Yeah.
Well, let's start there. If we can, let's start with the REDS. So relative energy deficiency. I think it's been known by a few different names academically and clinically for a while. But when I was coming up, there was the female athlete triad, which was basically, it was a very limited way to look at this process of basically saying this happens in women when they train too hard and they don't eat enough, right? And as we've expanded that, we realize, oh, wait, it doesn't just happen in women. There's more to it than that. It's kind of this, I think it falls somewhat on this overtraining spectrum, which again is a spectrum. It's a syndrome. It's a collection of symptoms. It's not one thing. And you were part of this group through the IOC that really was striving to, and I think did a very good job of defining this and then defining the clinical means by which we go about assessing and diagnosing.
To step it back a bit, though, can you tell us a little bit, what is REDS?
Yeah, so REDS is an extension of the female athlete triad that's a lot more broad and inclusive. And so the first IOC consensus on REDS was in 2014, and it was very quickly recognized that, as you've eloquently said, is, well, it's not just females, it's males. And it's not just three parameters of eating disorders resulting in amenorrhea, lack of menstrual cycle or menstrual dysfunction, resulting in poor bone mineral density and stress fractures. It's much broader. And when we think carefully in evolutionary biology, and we think about that whole scope of research that the Dan Lieberman's at Harvard pursue, like we've evolved as humans to go through feasts and famines. And if we think that low energy availability in a famine is just going to impact a few body systems, that just probably doesn't make much sense either. It's going to be multifactorial. And through evolution to survive famines, it probably makes sense that different body systems, whether it's, you know, your sex hormones, or your sex life, or the ability to reproduce might be further downregulated compared to preserving vital organs. and so it fits that way as well. And so relative energy deficiency in sport, the underlying cause of it is low energy availability. And the equation for low energy availability is really quite simple. It's energy intake minus exercise energy expenditure corrected by skeletal muscle mass or fat-free mass. So it's just energy intake minus exercise energy expenditure. And therefore, whatever calories are left over are what are available for the body to function and recover from exercise, support basal metabolic rate, support health, support reproductive health, and support growth and development. If you do a 2,000 calorie training session and only take in 2,000 calories for the day, your energy availability that day is zero. And so you're going to have to draw down upon your stores, whether it's adipose tissues or muscle glycogen, to help support basal metabolic rate that day. Basal metabolic rate we can measure in the lab as resting metabolic rate. It's a resting expenditure, and it very quickly can up and down regulate to try to compensate for caloric mismatches. It's a great evolutionary adaptation. And so
I think, sorry to interrupt, but I think that's a really important point that a lot of people don't recognize. They go have their resting metabolic rate measured and they kind of think that's my rate. That's who I am. Like it's genetic. It's really so much more variable than that and can be widely variable depending on activity rate, your dietary nutritional status at the time, all kinds of things. So just wanted to emphasize that point there.
Thank you for jumping in there. That absolutely. Yes. And, you know, with some studies you can impact resting metabolic rate within 2 or 3 days. So in weight making sports, like boxing or weigh in sports, like rowing, it adjusts quite a lot. And it compensates a lot. It's going to try to compensate and downregulate your basal metabolic rate, which is basically, I'm going to downregulate all the energetic recovery factors to your body to make sure you survive. It's basically, now in the new IOC consensus, we have, there's a very important term that it's hard to measure, but we've highlighted low energy availability is the cause of REDS, but we've termed it problematic low energy availability. And then there's another term, adaptable low energy availability, because there's an appreciation that every night when we go to bed, we don't eat for 8-9 hours. Every morning we wake up in low energy availability, but as long as you have breakfast, it's adaptable. It's not going to impact your health.
Yeah.
If you're obese and we purposely put you in low energy availability, your health outcomes improve. And so again, that's an adaptable, low energy availability state. Problematic.
To me,
yeah, go ahead.
I'm sorry. I was going to say, it reminds me of when we look at overtraining syndrome, functional overreaching versus non-functional overreaching. Like there's a point at which you want to stress the system if you're going for a certain outcome. And there's a point at which you do not want to stress the system if you're going to reach that outcome. And recognizing that from a caloric standpoint, dietary, energy balance. I think that's a really important recognition.
Yeah, that's a great analogy to the overtraining literature. And, you know, if you have aspirations for top 10 at a grand tour and you're not tired the month of January and February, it's probably not going to happen. Like there's a functional piece there that you got to live on the cliff there for a few months to get ready.
Well said.
Yeah. If you're really smashed and tired of the 2 days before the tour starts, then you got a problem. But, So the problematic low energy availability is that energy availability that's prolonged and or severe or too frequent. And we try to define it the best that we can. And when that happens, there's a downregulation of all physiological systems or many. The evidence for some of the body systems is better than the others as we evolve the literature. But there's also a psychological component of change in mood and anxiety and stress and depression. And sometimes that can lead to REDS or issues with eating or eating disorders or vice versa. And so, someone in REDS may have an eating disorder, but not all eating disorders are necessarily REDS. And everyone in REDS doesn't always have an eating disorder either. They are separate diagnostic criteria. Eating disorders are in the DSM-5 psychology diagnostic handbook. So there's complexity here. And then the signs and symptoms to REDS look very similar to the signs and symptoms to overtraining, but the cause is different. If the cause is an underfueling issue, it's REDS. If the athlete is fueling as much as they can, there's no other injuries and illnesses, no other disease states, there's no, the blood work looks normal and they're still having a maladaptation to training, then it's an overtraining syndrome situation. And my experience in the field and a review we did in the literature is that that isn't always as clear as it should be. And sometimes the cause of what people think is overtraining in many instances might actually be an underfueling issue, and it's actually a REDS issue. But that's tough for you clinicians and physicians to thread the needle on those pieces.
It really is. And I mean, even as you lay that out, I'm thinking of athletes through the years that I've worked with who I've diagnosed as an overtraining syndrome. And as we learned more and kind of dug into what was going on, it was absolutely an issue of energy availability.
I mean, and some might say, the signs and symptoms are more or less the same. They are. But I think how you go about treating it is very different.
Exactly.
You know,
athletes, and that's what matters.
Yeah.
What do you do next?
What do you do next? And athletes and coaches do not like to be told to train less. Yeah. They do not like to be told to rest. And certainly with REDS, the first step is let's try to eat more. How can we get more calories in your day? In extreme situations and with eating disorders, yes, we also have to downregulate the training piece of it. But if you think of the impact, and that's part of the reason why obesity is so prevalent, taking in, I just know this, taking in a Whopper is the same as a 20-kilometer run. It is it is really easy to get calories in. It really is. In theory, psychologically for summer athletes, it's really difficult to get calories in, but we're in such a calorie rich society and over processed food society. In many ways, the prevention of eating disorders and REDS should be on paper really straightforward, but obviously human nature and mental and psychology goes into it.
It's anything but straightforward. Mm-hmm. But I mean, you're right. It makes total sense that it should be very mathematical.
Yeah.
But you see those athletes who at the end of a 5K, the local 5K, they're downing multiple bagels and pizza. They've earned 2,500 calories in snacks. And then you see those athletes who go out and they burn thousands of calories and they just kind of, put back as little as they can. And to your point, it's not always an eating disorder. I can think of numerous athletes who ended up in this scenario and they were doing exactly as they were being coached to do from a nutrition standpoint. you know, they were following it to the T. They were just getting, well, bad advice. And so, you know, as soon as they were told, hey, you need to go eat some ice cream, like they were all over it. Right. But it's a complicated thing to, you know, nutrition is right there with religion and politics in terms of people's deeply held values on these things. And I think it becomes really a fine line to walk. And I find it really interesting that your career has focused on physiology and nutrition and that interaction. I don't know how common that is. It seems like I tend to run across people who are nutritionists or dietitians and people who are physiologists. And sometimes they kind of play on the other side of the fence, but to have the background you do solidly, I was going to say in both camps, but really where they cross, I think is a unique skill set that's really a one in high demand, whether people recognize it or not.
Yeah, thanks for that, Kevin. I'm not a registered dietitian. I always say that right up front. And
sure,
the training that RDs have and our amazing sports dietitians at the Institute, their training and unique training in clinical aspects and food preparation and behavior change management. Like those are courses actually everyone should take on behavior change stuff. I have a master's student doing a policy behavior change project right now on Reds and changing Reds behavior. And obviously we have other experts because that's not my area. And I'm learning as much as she is.
That's awesome.
And so I agree with you. And nutrition is part religious. It is culture. It is, you know, it's really deeply embedded in what we do. When you come together as people and friends and family, you sit and eat together, right? And you break bread together and all those aspects. And the way I look at it, and I've said this on other podcasts, is, you know, it's much less likely open heart surgeons in the public domain are having arguments. And that's because not all of us do open heart surgery, or right, not all of us fly a plane, right? The pilots. And
you don't often run across someone.
Yeah, exactly. All of us eat. So we all have an opinion, you know, but I fly in a lot of planes. You don't want me up there being the pilot.
No,
you know,
or even so, giving input in my
or giving case. Input, right? So, yeah. Twitter is full of pilot nutritionists, right? So they're for sure. and because they have an experience, and you know, if someone goes keto and loses a lot of weight, and their health improves, and their self esteem improves, of course they're going to have this religious experience with that diet. But the blinders are that this is going to help everyone, and it's not, you know, So. It's interesting. Yeah.
No, well said. Well, I'd like to, if I can, take the opportunity a bit selfishly and throw some topics at you that are kind of nutritional physiology topics that are either things that I've been in conversations around a lot recently, or that are just kind of hot topics that are out there that patients of mine often ask about. The one I'd like to start with is carbohydrate intake during endurance exercise, specifically competition. You know, it used to be we always targeted kind of 90 grams an hour. 60 to 90 was considered kind of okay. 90 was probably the ceiling. And now you see athletes doing, really aiming for 120, almost as a new gold standard, that if you're going to compete, you got to get this much in. And to your point just a second ago about how personal experience influences these things, I think one, we've learned that there probably is a higher ceiling than we thought, but two, personal experience and individual variance when looking at your goal carbohydrate intake, it varies. And it's not as simple as reading a Runner's World article about somebody who's taken in 120 and saying, oh, I'm going to do that. So that's not really a question. That's a statement that I'm saying run with, but I'd love to hear your thoughts on it.
Yeah. I was part of an amazing project that just recently got published and comes out of James Morton's lab, and James worked a long time with Team Sky. And long story short is we had subjects come in a bunch of times, and we used different combinations and types of carbohydrates, sports drink and gels and gummies. And we were able to quite effectively get up to 120 grams an hour with minimal GI side effects. Cause that's the sweet spot you're looking at.
Yeah.
Every athlete can take in 120 grams an hour, but if they're on the side of the road at the Porta John and Porta Potty or throwing up, it, you know, performance, there'll be a performance decrement.
Yeah.
So back in 2014, actually, Greg Cox, originally out of the Australian Institute of Sport, and myself did a systematic review on carbohydrate intake and performance. And at that point already, in a figure, it wasn't a consensus statement, but we actually had an upper range in the mode of cycling of up to about 110 grams an hour. And that was just through experience that we had in triathlon and in cycling, where the exercise intensities are lower than marathon running. And in many instances, the ballistic nature and bouncing nature of running does lower carbohydrate intake. So I will highlight that the, you know, the new bar of 120 grams an hour is probably more in a cycling, long distance triathlon, Ironmans, those sports. It's sure. Still pretty challenging to get to those numbers in most marathon runners. Mainly because a marathon, elite marathoning, is done at 85 to 90% of VO2 max. Well, on an easier tour stage, you know, guys in the bunch, if they don't have to chase breakaways, you know, their heart rates are, you know, 120, 130. It's not that intense. They can get fuel in and they can eat throughout those stages. So
for sure. And even in the breakaway, you've got a car there. They can hand you stuff, liquid fuels. Even if your heartbeat or your heart rate is, you know, 160, 170, you can squeeze a bottle and take gulps. You can't do that running.
Totally. And that's another piece, is the availability of carbohydrate and fluid is different in sports. Like if you're thirsty and feeling a bonk and running and your next aid station's 4K away, like you're hooped. It's going to be hard. You're still probably hooped in cycling, but, at least you got a bottle, in most instances, down underneath you, or a domestique to get you one. But
yeah.
So yeah, like there's value, and we've known for many, many years that, you know, the more we can push carbohydrate oxidation, the more efficient it is than fat oxidation. It's 100% carbohydrate oxidation is 5% more efficient than 100% fat oxidation. To put that in perspective, you know, the revolution of the new running shoes, like the Nike 4%, the super shoes, that was a 4% improvement in running economy. Like we're talking about a 5% improvement in running economy just by being really well carbohydrate fueled and carbohydrate loaded.
It's a great way to think about it. Yeah.
You know, that revolutionized the sport of marathoning, those shoes. And and so the other thing to remember too is in multiple tour stages, if you can take in, instead of 70 or 80, you can take in 100 to 110 grams and it's a 4 or 5 hour stage, you've taken on another 400 or 500 calories. So not only has it helped you in that stage, you have less of a hole to dig out of day to day to day to day. And that compounds and that adds up over a grand tour or some of the, you know, the shorter tours, the Tour of Switzerland's and the others. So that's a big piece too. It kickstarts recovery.
And that part I think is important for even the recreational athlete to recognize in a training scenario, a heavy training block. A lot of times if you can get carbohydrate in, even at the end of a ride, end of a run, where you don't necessarily need it for that performance, you're starting to improve things for your recovery afterwards, your overnight and the next day's activity. So that's really, it sounds like it's very specific to stage racing and cycling, but if you step back, that's one that I think we can all walk away with something usable.
Yeah, very important context to add. Yeah, Kevin, I agree, and it helps with the prevention of problematic low energy availability over time.
Exactly,
you know, you're in less of a hole day to day to day to day, and you know there's other elements there too. In the last 20 years, like Astrid Jukendrup led most of this research. He works with Jumbo Visma. Glucose fructose blends are absorbed better than glucose or fructose alone. Mm-hmm. There's hydrogel blends now, which seem to slightly increase gastric emptying rates, which helps with GI outcomes as well. So there's been some sport nutrition advances in formulations that help as well to deliver those amounts.
Yeah.
We know you can train the gut. There's indirect evidence of that. A fair amount of papers showing evidence of lower gastrointestinal issues if you continue to work at it, continue to train it, continue to push those carbs. We know in animal models, the transporters that absorb carbohydrate across the intestine, there's a separate transporter for glucose and fructose. They are upregulated when you put a lot of carbohydrate or artificial sweetener, in fact, into an animal model. So your transporters increase. So it's like having more doors on the busy subway. More glucose can get across into the bloodstream. So there's benefits there. You have to start a bit lower and work your way up. And then finally, there's obscure data looking at a tracer where they bypass the gut and infuse glucose. That's Louise Burke's husband, John Hawley, published this paper about 30 years ago. And indeed, at the muscle, it does look like the muscle can take in, 120, maybe 130 grams per hour. And then the transporters and the muscles probably get saturated as well. So I tend to think personally, others might think otherwise, that the upper limit is around that 120 to 130, given that muscle saturation paper. One paper. We should probably go back and look at that a little more in depth. But much beyond that, it's hard not to feel incredibly bloated and have gastrointestinal issues. But it is doable for some athletes. But as you said at the start, the individual range can be quite wide. So some athletes just, they get to 60 grams an hour, 80, 70 grams an hour. It's just what they can tolerate. And we try different ways to deliver it, and they're always having a gastro. So it also needs to be individually trialed.
There's some evidence too. I know the guys at Morton have done, and some other researchers in the UK have been publishing some work regarding that upper limit and looking at, with carbon labeled carbohydrates, basically, where for people who are not into science, they can tag the carbohydrate that you take in, so they know what the burn rate is for that exogenous, that eaten carbohydrate, as opposed to just what's already living in the muscle. And it looks like, as I understand it, that if you make carbohydrate so readily available, you eat so much of it that it's just no longer seen as a limited resource, that the efficiency with which your body burns through it decreases. So the burn rate goes up, and even though you're putting in more, you don't get more life out of it necessarily. The tank doesn't stay full longer because you burn it quicker. So if that's the case, it just lends more credence to the fact that there is a sweet spot. It's not just more is better. It's finding where you're going to perform best. And there's going to be some individual variance to that.
Yeah. Every single enzyme in the human body is eventually rate limiting.
Yeah.
And so it's good to keep that first principle top of mind. At some point, it's, things are... Yeah, so,
exactly. Yeah. From a clinician standpoint, everything has a dose response curve.
Right? Yes.
So you give a little bit, you're not going to see much of an effect. You give a little more, you're going to see an effect. You give more than that, you might cause a death or cause toxic issues.
And most dose response curves are sigmoidal. Not all, but most.
Yeah. Yeah. Moving to another macronutrient, protein. So it's funny. I feel like I'm getting old. One, because I am, but two, I'm at a point in my career where I'm starting to see things, come around again. You start to see these, like fat was bad and fat is great and carbs are bad and carbs are okay. And well, now we got to talk about protein, right? So it seems like there's a protein is having its day in the sun, and everybody is pushing for higher protein levels. And I think there's probably some good to that. But In sport in particular, we look at protein as a way to really support recovery, muscular recovery. And we look at amounts and we look at timing of that protein. So I was wondering if you could talk through kind of what you see as best practices for an athlete, recreational, elite, professional, who it seems to be the case in my experience that a lot of endurance athletes fall short on protein intake. And so how would we kind of coach them to do better, or what looks really optimal for protein intake?
Yeah. So there's a lot here to unpack and to try to really nail down. First, I'd like to emphasize that certainly most of the studies in the sport literature look at protein and muscle recovery. But protein helps with all protein synthesis in the entire body. And so, for example, there's a dose response relationship after exercise, where the sweet spot for protein on an acute dose is around, 20 grams of protein for muscle protein synthesis. In that same study by Dan Moore, that was also the sweet spot for blood albumin protein synthesis. Your red blood cells, your albumin, those are all proteins. In the lab I worked at in Maastricht, they have a technique where they intrinsically label protein. And I'll explain what that means. They use a tracer, like you mentioned before, for glucose. This time it's an amino acid tracer. They put about a quarter of a million euros into a cow. They then milk the cow. The tracer ends up in the milk. The people in the study can then drink the milk, because normally we infuse tracer into the arm and we bypass the gut.
Yeah.
Well, guess what? 50% of all proteins you eat don't even reach the bloodstream. They are just completely soaked up and taken by the gastrointestinal tract, or splanchnic extraction is what a scientist call it, is all, everything involved with the gastrointestinal tract. It basically means we don't know where the hell it goes.
Right.
But when we think about the gastrointestinal tract, I'm just going to get into a little rabbit hole here.
No, I like it. Go for it.
It is literally the sacred lumen that separates your body from the outside world. It turns over its cells in the gastrointestinal tract, the enterocytes, turn over every 5 to 7 days. You have a brand new intestinal tract. It turns over because it wants cells that are really healthy and do a really good job at keeping pathogens out, but allowing food and hydration and nutrition and micronutrients in. And so, of course, protein is really important for gut health as well, muscle health. So we have to widen the scope beyond just muscle recovery.
That's a great point. Yeah.
If you look at, and I'm biased because I did a sabbatical in Professor Phillips' lab at McMaster University in Canada. And I did my postdoc with Luc Van Loon in Maastricht. And the two of them, I think, are probably the two global leaders on exercise and protein, and especially Luc's lab, with Wim Saris. They did a bunch of the Tour de France original double label water energetic studies that are just so cool. And there's a lot of principles we can come out with, and I'm going to rattle through a few things for people to think about. One is, how much protein can you assimilate in a single sitting of about 4 to 6 hours? That dose response was done after exercise, and it is about, for an average sized person, about 20 grams of protein. You can have increased protein synthesis up to about 20 or 30 grams in that area. If you go to 40 grams of protein, the protein synthesis doesn't appreciably increase more. There's a dose response relationship. Mm-hmm. There's a saturation. That's about 0.3 grams per kg body weight if you're a really big rower or a really big bloke. Or if you're very petite, it might just be 15 grams. Mm-hmm. We know proteins high in leucine outperform other proteins. So whey protein will result in more muscle protein synthesis than soy, for example, primarily driven by the fact that leucine is the key amino acid that turns on the molecular machinery in your muscle, mTOR, to turn on muscle protein synthesis. Leucine is part of the three branch chain amino acids. Most experts would say any of the positive research around the branch chain amino acids is probably just because leucine's in there. Yeah. Isoleucine and valine are just coming along for the ride. And if you redid all those studies and just had leucine, you probably would have had the same effects.
Yeah.
So there's that piece to protein type. I was involved in an impressive project with an insane amount of biopsies where we dosed protein multiple times throughout an entire 8-hour infusion. So we could look at muscle protein synthesis at 2 hours, 4 hours, 6 hours, and 8 hours after exercise, where we did like mega dosing of 40 grams twice, 20 grams four times, or 10 grams eight times. So at the end of the 8 hours, everyone got the same amount of protein.
Yeah.
Indeed, the 20 grams every 4 hours, or every 4 hours, excuse me, was the most effective way to deliver protein. Huh. So what that means is throughout your day, you have to think about getting that 20 or 30 grams of protein 4 or 5 times throughout the day, each time, you know, 3 or 4 hours apart. You will have a much better spread and assimilation and effectiveness of that protein. You know, you'll get to your 100 or 120 grams you need for the day versus at the end of the, you know, someone else at the end of the day just eats a massive steak. You know, they've checked the box for their daily protein requirement. But in fact, because it's too much all at once for your body to assimilate, you end up just excreting expensive nitrogen urine out. There's an overspill of the protein. So yeah. Spreading the protein throughout the day is really important. Most athletes and most most individuals do not meet their 20 to 30 grams of protein at breakfast. That tends to be a meal to focus on.
Yeah.
And so when we think about it, not only have you had a 10-hour, 8-hour sleep, you've now not meet your protein requirement at breakfast. So then you're at a 15 to 16 hours where you actually haven't gotten a protein dose that's high enough to maximize the protein turnover for the body. Finally, there's some evidence, and I think more work needs to be done on this. So the amount of protein you need on the day to stay in nitrogen balance for people that exercise, because when you exercise, you turn over proteins quickly, is somewhere around, you know, 1.8 to 2 grams per kg body weight per day. I do think we still need to do a study where we pressure test that in real world athletes who are training 30 hours a week. We know when glycogen's low, some protein is oxidized for energy. As glycogen depletes, that can be as much as 10 to 12% of total energy coming from protein stores. And I just note that a lot of professional cyclists and rowers who are in 30-hour training weeks self-select 2.5 to 3 grams per kg body weight of protein per day. That's theoretically higher than you need. It would suggest that you would have nitrogen spillover. I'm not personally convinced of that. And I think shooting for those levels and those really high volume sports is important.
It's really hard to do, though.
Yeah, most of the protein studies have been done in a running model, which is a dumb model to me. Runners only run 8 or 10 hours a week. We're low volume animals, like compared to triathletes, cyclists, and rowers and swimmers. So that was a whole bunch of FYI, but I thought I'd just run down the list.
No, I'm glad you did. That was great, and that's exactly what I was looking for around protein. It's two things jump out at me. One, the boluses or the meals of 20 grams at a time. I think that's a really important piece that a lot of people aren't aware of, that you do get diminishing returns by just adding on top of that. But that also in combination with a goal of call it 2 grams per kg body weight in a day or more makes it really difficult to check those two boxes. I think one of the things when we work with patients, athletes, and we have them do a food log. I'm not a big fan of continuous food logs. We can discuss whether that's a shared opinion, but 3, 4, or 5 days max, see what they're doing, more for broad strokes than granular input.
I agree with that.
Okay.
Yeah.
But you can see then if somebody is, you know, I don't care whether they're getting 95 grams versus 100 grams. I want to know, are they getting 100, 120, 140? And you start to see just how difficult it is to reach those targets on a daily basis. But then if you say you've got to do it, you don't have to, but if the ideal is to do it in 20 gram increments, that's a lot of protein intakes through the day, and you have to be very mindful of it. And if you start out skipping protein at breakfast, I think it's, you can't do it. Like you will fail that day. And it's as an athlete, you're putting yourself at a huge disadvantage to do that day after day.
Yeah, no, you've done it well. And I think food logs have a place, just as an aside, for the reason you said. The accuracy of them might be plus or minus 20 to 30%, but they are nice just to see, how does the athlete structuring their eating throughout the day? What is the timing? What's the approximate macros? Because you can then get a lot of discussion points to improve on. So they do have a role that way.
Go ahead. So I've run into this numerous times with athletes on the pro level and on down, where especially now with the apps that allow you to keep a food log, it looks so precise, right? You put it, you scan a barcode and the Clif Bar goes in, or, you know, you enter that you had a chicken breast, medium size, and it puts in these exact numbers, right? And I think it's lost on many athletes, if not everyone, that there is error in the nutrition label. There is allowable error in the nutrition label. There is allowable error in the estimate in the app, and there's error for sure in what we estimate we're eating. And when you put all that together, I mean, if you get to 20% an accuracy that's, you know, plus minus 20%, that's really damn good, I think.
Yeah.
I mean, I think most of them are probably worse than that. So to your point, my takeaway with these is, again, general macronutrient intake, right? It's a really hard way to look at much more minor things, but general macronutrient intake, calorie buckets. So are you, you know, plus minus 500, plus minus 1,000? And then when you start to recognize why it is you're using it, and like you said, quality, I'm really more interested in reading what they ate as opposed to the numbers out by the side of it, and the timing. And when you can bucket it a bit in terms of its importance, I think it's a much more usable tool. If you just hand it to somebody and they see this shiny app that gives you graphs at the end of the day that looks as if it's gospel, it can be really maladaptive and counterproductive. But that's my soapbox. I'm going to step off of it now.
Completely agree. Let's just take something as regulated or as the amount of caffeine measured in an espresso capsule. Yeah. You think, oh, that'll be pretty dialed in. Actually, there's a paper showing the min and the max when they measured about 20 of them was 200% different.
No way.
So our food processing, it does its best. But they're just on that side, just the label accuracy, the plus and minus of what you can get there is tough. And there is a review paper around the challenges of food intake and dietary records in athletes. Because vitamin A is so variably distributed in foods, and there's so much variability at different times of the season, to get an accurate average vitamin A intake for an athlete, an individual athlete, you need to do dietary records for about 360 days straight.
Okay.
Just for vitamin A. Now it's only about 20 days straight for carbs because it's more ubiquitous, but the accuracy is really tough. Looking for patterns, looking for timing, looking for food quality, a great tool to periodically use. And then finally, there is evidence that both lived and also some published evidence that and athletes are we select for this. They're especially obsessive compulsive. And anytime you give an app or another element to become especially obsessive compulsive about it, anything done to an extreme has a downside. And don't get me wrong, like I love obsessive compulsive athletes that are able to manage that right at the edge of the cliff.
Yeah. Very, very teachable at that point. Tell them what to do and they're going to do it.
Oh my God. They nail it. They nail the training. And like, I can tell just by how accurate training logs are from prescription. Like I don't need a psych consult to know where this athlete lies on things and what other opportunities lie, but also red flags. Like, okay, I'm going to, you know, with something maybe around dietary tracking, I need to be careful here because it's going to be a slippery slope for their personality, so to speak. So yeah, food records are have a time and a place, but you also have to appreciate there's pros and can be big cons to them.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, there's definitely athletes I've worked with through the years where we have a conversation as their team, you know, their nutritionist they work with, their coach, whoever, that's just a non-starter. We're not doing food logging with that yeah. athlete. It's the risk is too high.
A great approach to take. It is.
Well, let me, in the few minutes I have left with you, I would love to kind of take the nutrition piece and move into physiology a little bit more and look at environmental inputs on physiology in general, but also kind of the crossover with nutrition. So one of the things I'm thinking is with altitude. You know, we take athletes to altitude camps ahead of big events, and a lot of them are kind of surprised to hear that their caloric requirement, even at rest, is higher, and that their carbohydrate requirement at rest is higher just because of the altitude. So I'd love to kind of talk a little bit, and we can just make this conversational, but nutrition at altitude and nutrition around heat and cold. And both of these could be full podcasts on their own, but I think it's really interesting just to introduce people to the idea that the confluence of these things matters and it impacts what is best practice in that situation.
Yeah. A classic COVID project. We punched out a bunch of reviews on altitude and nutrition and altitude training. One of them was with Inigo Majuka out of Basque Country, who has worked with Euskadel Euskadi for many, many years. And they're great COVID projects and just bring both practical sense of training and nutrition together. And I just want to highlight that there is a huge or large literature around the physiological impacts of altitude. However, the vast majority of those papers are done at 4,300 meters, which just happens to be the U.S. Army research base at Pikes Peak.
Yeah.
And the relevancy of
4,000. Nobody trains there.
No, that's like 10,000 feet plus. You know, the sweet spot for altitude training for athletes is 7,000 to 8,000 feet, 1,800 to 2,400 meters. And if you look around the world at all the hotspots, they're all in that sweet band because they're high enough to get the right hypoxic dose to allow for an erythropoietic response and allow for hypoxic inducing factor, HIF-1 alpha response in the muscle. Mm-hmm. But not so high that the maladaptation to training falls off the cliff. Like when it's just so high, you can't hit the watts or the running speeds you need. Yeah. The recovery is so long. The risk for muscle wasting and sarcopenia and all these other outcomes are exacerbated. So
you end up with lots of red blood cells, but no good fitness. Like you can't do the intensity, nothing that's sport specific. So that's where that sweet spot comes in.
Exactly. And at certain times of the year, that sweet spot altitude also has access to lower altitudes. Because if you're going into a competition phase, I do think it's an advantage to get down to more sea level-ish to really hit the specificity that you need to do. If it's a fall training camp, I don't care as much. Just put the miles in. So even like where you go at certain times of the year changes. So anyways, our knowledge of nutrition and physiological adaptations at 7,000 to 8,000 feet is actually really limited. There's not a lot of papers and it's much more experiential. So for example, there is one paper with six athletes that shows a 16 or 18% increase in basal metabolic rate at 2,000 meters. That's all we have.
Yeah.
Now I know the authors. They're a good lab. I even know what metabolic cart they used. It was an Olympic level rowers, and all six athletes on the individual data did have an increase in BMR. So I do think there's an increase in RMR at 2,000 meters. There certainly is at 4,000 meters. Mm-hmm. But I mean, and that's a pretty easy study to do. You just need a metabolic cart and you measure resting. Guys, come in before breakfast, lay here for 20 minutes. All right, carry on with your day. Let's just do that throughout an altitude camp with a bigger group of athletes. Like Kevin, you could nail that with EF at a training camp. It's really...
Well, maybe we will.
There you go. Yeah. It's really easy to do, right? Like, it's pretty non-invasive. It takes a little bit of athlete time. So yes, I do expect basal metabolic rate goes up. So the energetic cost of living day to day might be 15 to 20% higher. Because you're more anaerobic at altitude on everything, there's an increased carbohydrate cost. Mm-hmm. So the likelihood that you're churning through more muscle glycogen goes up. Therefore, the need and requirement to increase carbohydrate, both fueling in sessions, but also daily carbohydrate needs to go up, you know, maybe 10, 20%. There is increased oxidative stress. I would not use antioxidants to combat that. High dose antioxidants tend to limit aerobic adaptations.
Yeah, we want that stress, that signal.
You want that signal. It helps with mitochondria biogenesis or growth. That said, a great researcher out of Norway, Anu Kuvatsu, has a couple of papers now showing, and this fits with the general literature too, if we increase fruits and veggies at altitude, that's a great intervention rather than a single dose high oxidant vitamin C or vitamin E, like just increase the total fruits and veggies. It helps with recovery and it has no maladaptive responses to training adaptation. We know that from the health literature as well. Mother Nature knows what she's doing when she's making an apple with 600 different metabolites that we've identified so far. Why we take one of them out?
There's your 10, 15% carbohydrate intake increase there as well.
Exactly, like juicers and exactly. Yeah. So you have to be a little more conscious of that. Altitude increases hydration needs because you're just in drier air. You tend to have more sun effect as well. So you just have to be a little bit more on your hydration protocols and just checking in on that. But those are probably my big ones. Plus or minus, some athletes like to incorporate beetroot a little more often at altitude. There's some data suggests that, especially in an oxygen limiting environment, that the nitrates might have a further effect there. I think the sea level data suggests that unless your VO2 max is over 65, you don't get a further benefit from nitrates. I know some athletes that do like to incorporate that on really key, intense training sessions at altitude. Yeah. So that's probably my big altitude ones. Oh, iron. Geez. Yeah. The biggest one. Thank you, Kevin.
No problem. Just a little nudge.
Yeah. The big one. So, you know, when you're making new red blood cells, every hemoglobin has four iron molecules. So it does draw down upon your iron stores, which are your ferritin stores. And so your iron needs at altitude, especially early in altitude or over 3 week camps, can be doubled to tripled to what you need at sea level. And so we've published a couple of papers in this space, and we do recommend somewhere between 100 to 200 milligrams of elemental iron as a supplement per day for most individuals who have, you know, a ferritin under 150. If you're over 150, talk to your physician and, you know, maybe you need 50 milligrams or a much lower dose, but that requires blood work to be done, you know, 4 to 6 weeks in advance, get a sense of where your ferritin is. If you have access to hemoglobin mass measurement through carbon monoxide rebreathe, our lab does it. We know other labs around the world at altitude locations that do it. That can be a really nice way.
Not easy to find, but a really nice tool.
It is. Yeah. There's a lab in Flagstaff that does it for $100. Dan Berglund at Hypo2. Cool. Yeah. But it is obscure technique for sure. And, but the big thing is really that iron bioavailability and in most instances, ferritin will drop at altitude because it's using that iron stores to make more red blood cells. And even at 100 milligrams of elemental iron per day, you'll still, in most of your athletes, get a drop in ferritin. When you get to 200, usually there's a small increase in ferritin, but not like you would see at sea level over 3 weeks.
Yeah.
Again, a lot of that is being used to make new red blood cells.
Is there an increased protein requirement for that reason because of red blood cell generation?
You know what? Great question, because I highlighted that earlier about the albumin turnover. Yes. So certainly at extreme altitudes, so those Pike Peaks Army research data, yes, for sure there's an increased protein requirement. I don't think we can definitively say at moderate altitudes whether there is. I would still adhere to trying to all the recommendations we just made 15 sure. minutes ago on the podcast. Theoretically, there would be a very small increase, but we're not in a position to really say go for it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Going back to our very original conversation about being confident in what we tell people, we're recognizing that that could change in a year or two when the next study is published.
That's true. Yeah.
And then the last thing I want to ask about is kind of this along the same lines, but with respect to heat. One of the things that we've seen in World Tour cycling, but really in all of the sports that I work in, is the increasing temperatures of Earth in general are impacting sporting events. And I mean, I can see it myself looking at Tours de France through the years. When I first started 15 years ago with this EF team, to now, how much of a determinant it is with respect to performance. Whereas before it was there, but it was kind of like, yeah, it's hot. You just throw some ice down your shirt. We're getting much more sophisticated about it now out of necessity. And I'm curious how nutritional requirements change in the heat and even in the cold as well.
Yeah. So, global warming is not going away. And I think teams and sports and athletes need to be more conscious and aware of various heat mitigating protocols and heat acclimation protocols. And there's a lot of really positive data to show that, the amount of blood plasma volume albumin you can have can increase 5 to 10% in 5 days in the heat. Like your body does adapt really quick. Your sweat rate takes a little longer, 10 to 14 days, but your body is quite dynamic at handling the heat. And therefore, you know, even just 5 or 6 days of heat training that's a little more moderate can really help in a race in the heat. When it comes to nutrition, obviously hydration is number one. You're going to be sweating more. You're going to be turning your body fluids over more often. The metric system is great, folks. 1 kilogram of body weight equals 1 liter of sweat. And you can start to track your own. Anyone with a weigh scale, if they subject out what they've drank, you can calculate percent body weight losses and how much fluids per hour you're churning through. When we head to Italy with our heavyweight, open weight men's rowers, some of them are sweating close to 2 liters an hour. But these are 220, 240 pound endurance athletes. So,
yeah, using upper and lower body.
Upper and lower. Time.
Yeah.
In the humidity. And, you know, we always base near Como. So it's hot and humid. So, so you can, any hobby scientist, anyone can measure that just through weight tracking and get a sense of what your needs are. So that's a biggie. Obviously, electrolyte turnover is higher. There's some evidence that's quite individual. Some people might lose 2 or 3 thousand milligrams or grams of salt. Other individuals might be 10 or 12 grams of salt on a given afternoon. And that's 6 times the recommended dietary allowance for salt. But you need it. So salt and electrolytes in your drink are a help, but honestly, sodium through food intake is one of the best ways to replenish electrolytes and to allow for fluid retention. We know in the heat as well as the cold, extreme conditions increase glycogen turnover, the use of glycogen. You burn through more glycogen in the heat as well as in extreme cold conditions. So you just have to be conscious of that. And then finally, probably the last thing, especially in the heat, to consider is that blood flow redistribution during exercise is already extreme and away from the gut. It is even more extreme in the heat. So your likelihood of gastrointestinal issues and other GI side effects is exacerbated and increased. It can be worked on and trained, but your upper limit, even though you need lots of carbs, might come down a little bit in the heat because you're probably going to be more likely to have gastrointestinal issues. So that's probably my highlight reel on that one, unless I missed something really obvious like iron last time. Give me a
point. No. No, I think that was great. I would add maybe a focus on hydration even in the cold, because it's fairly obvious in hot environments. But one of the things I've seen just experientially with athletes is often when it's cold, it's dry. Not always, but often. And there isn't the same signal or pressure to drink. And so while the requirement may not be as high as in the heat, oftentimes the intake is considerably less and they end up, you know, back at the bus, way underhydrated and really kind of scratching their head as to why. You know, they're like, I drank while I was out there. It's kind of a unique setting. We see this in the classics, cold, kind of spit and snow sometimes even.
Yeah.
And there's just no drive to drink. And then they get back just kind of wrung dry and no idea why. So yeah, I would add that, especially given the time of year that we're in at the moment, recording this in December, remember to drink year round.
Yeah. And I would add $50. They didn't have enough carbs that day either, because a lot of times you're delivering fluid for hydration, but also fluid for fueling.
Yeah.
If you don't have that desire to drink your sports drink, then you're missing out on both those. And it's really easy to underfuel on cold days too.
It is. Cycling teams, one of the secrets that's often utilized by soigneurs is the first bottle or two that are in the cage is like this really dilute porridge. So it's like an oatmeal that is very watery so they can squeeze it out. It's hot and the riders just want to drink it. So it's loaded with carbohydrate, keep you warm, start you off on the right foot. Can't be obviously too concentrated or you have just this rock in your gut. But it's a, if you dial it in just right, it's a really nice way to start the ride. And you can use that on a training ride.
Yeah. Or hot tea with 6 scoops of sugar.
There you go. Perfect.
Yeah.
Yeah. Apple cider.
Yep. Oh yeah. There's lots of ways. And, actually in Kenya at altitude, it's quite cool after the morning runs, and, the Kenyans will come in and you watch, and they always have tea. It's like seven, eight scoops of sugar.
Yeah.
And you're kind of like watching. I'm like, they're just listening to what their body needs at that point. They're a little bit chilled from the run and they want some, they got to replenish because they're going to go again at 4 PM, right? So
exactly. Yeah. And if you had a glucose monitor on them, there'd probably be almost no blip, right? Like it just gets sucked into the muscles.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a great way to do it. Not after a day sitting at the desk.
No.
Right. Just working. Don't do your 7 scoops of sugar. But it's all situational.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Cool. Well, I really appreciate you taking the time to kind of geek out on some of this stuff with me. I love it. You mentioned Dan Lieberman earlier. And I made a mental note. So at the Tour de France start in Copenhagen.
Yep.
I went up there. I actually couldn't be with the team. We had COVID in the house as I was heading up there.
Yeah.
I was well, but I was like, I'm not going to get near the team. No. Whatever.
Yeah, so don't
I'm
outside be that the guy. Barriers.
No. So I was outside the barriers, but kind of, watching the TT, and I looked around and all the crowd is fixated on the cycling stars going by, right?
Yeah.
Everybody riding by. And I look over and I see Dan Lieberman standing there watching the race. And in my head, I'm like, okay, there go these cyclists, but that guy, like, I'd love to go talk to him. And I realized what a nerd I was.
Yeah.
So, it's fun to dig into these topics really academically. I love it. I really appreciate you taking the time. And thank you for the conversation.
Yeah. Thanks, Kevin. And, Dan and I spoke at ACSM this year and, keep in touch, and, he's a real mentor. And, I'll let him know that he was picked out of a lineup. He'll be humbled. So
yeah, do. Yeah. I could tell from his shoes.
Oh, right. Yeah. Yeah. There was a sports science conference going on there. I know he was over there at that time. So that's good eyes. Yeah.
Cool. Well, thank you. And, I might have to wrangle you back on here eventually and maybe go deep on one topic instead of shallow on a bunch. But I loved it and I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Kevin, for having me on. It was a great conversation.
Thanks for listening to The Podium. To hear more, be sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. You can follow us on Instagram, where I am at Dr. Kevin Sprouse. That's at Dr. Kevin Sprouse. The podcast posts at @the_podium_podcast. You can also find and follow me on Strava. The content of this podcast is meant for general informational and educational purposes only and does not constitute medical advice. No doctor-patient relationship is formed. All listeners should speak with their doctor or medical practitioner before implementing any change in their healthcare regimen. If you're currently a patient at Podium, then you have an established doctor-patient relationship with me, and I'm happy to discuss this with you. If you're not currently a patient at Podium, nothing in this recording establishes a doctor-patient relationship between us, nor does it constitute the practice of medicine, nor the dissemination of medical advice. Should you implement any information contained herein without consulting your own physician, you do so at your own risk. The Podium Podcast is a Palm Tree Podco production. Our executive producer is Anthony Palmer, and the associate producer is Garrett Wright. Thanks to our digital team, Emily Miles and Caitlin Krings. Content for this episode was created by the team at The Podium.